What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Make it kind.
M.I.P.
With Masamela Mafumo.
Mark Thompson.
Make it kind.
Get woke.
Ladies and gentlemen, in studio today, a very special guest. I didn't recognize her from the last time I saw her, because the last time I saw her, she was about 12 feet tall. And I didn't remember, okay, that's, you know, but I was, this is the angle I was looking up at. I just, it was just like this very, very tall person. She was standing on a stool, quite perilously, in fact, because several of us were trying to hold the stool so this person could talk. And poor Rem Barber was trying to hold it up, and his people worried about him, like, is he going to fall? And then, you know, it's one of the kind of things where everybody's trying to hold everybody up. Mm-hmm. And if he falls, then I would have fallen, and two other people just would have been a total.
Dominoes.
There's been a whole situation. But fortunately, the Lord was there for us and kept her lifted up there. And she gave, she spoke at one of the impeachment marches and rallies during the course of impeachment. She is with the Center for Popular Democracy. Jennifer Epps Addison is here in studio with us. How are you?
I am so good, brother. Thank you so much for having me. I thought you were going to say, because, you know, I'm a black woman. And so every time you see me, my hair is likely to be different. And I think
that's true,
that
too. You wearing my, your hair different,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I had a nice long.
You did. It was down.
It was
really
good.
Yeah. But I
good hair that day.
It's always good. It's always good, Jennifer. But, you know, I even, because I was streaming it on social media, some of it. And so people, if you are saw the stream from, you see this person and all you see is her. It was a beautiful day that day.
Yeah, it was gorgeous.
Blue sky and clouds and everything.
Thousands of people out to demand accountability of this government.
Well, let's start there in the aftermath of all that. Mm. Where was it worth it? Mm. Will it have a lasting effect? Some, of course, in the mainstream media being what it is, saw it as us losing. Mm-hmm. And, oh, we shouldn't have done it. It was a waste of time and it doesn't mean anything. Mm. But from your point of view, especially as you engage everyday people, is that going to have a lasting effect? Is it going to stay with people?
I mean, you know, Nelson Mandela tells us that everything is impossible until it's done, right? And so I think there's a lot of vested interest in this country trying to suppress people's expression, to suppress people from, going directly to the source of power and telling them that they're not being represented. There's a vested interest in keeping us feeling like nothing we do matters. And so, of course, they're going to say that at the end of the day, this president is impeached. That will forever be the case. Not only is he impeached, but he was impeached with the largest number of votes in Congress ever in the history of impeachment. And he went on to a sham trial in the Senate that will forever be a stain on those Republicans who failed to do their duty to country and instead chose, you know, not even partisan politics, but really chose to, undermine the very values we have in this country. This is the first impeachment trial in the history of the United States that did not call witnesses. Mm. I mean, let that sink in for a second. Yeah, and so when people say, did we lose? No, we won. We impeached. Our goal was to impeach this president, and we did. Mm-hmm. We were very clear that it was unlikely that members of the Senate would do their duty to this country. And we believe, just like with Justice Kavanaugh, when we stood tall, and even though they told us you can't disrupt a Supreme Court hearing, you're not going to be able to do anything with this hearing, we went from a hearing that was supposed to be a one and done, one day, slam dunk and done, to weeks of women in protest, and then to the most transformative congressional midterm elections we've ever seen in this country, where we elected the most diverse, most progressive, most female Congress in the history of the country. Yeah. I believe we will see the impact of impeachment on this election, you know, not just because Trump's base will be motivated, but because, you know, people, you are seeing it, middle of the road, moderates, conservatives, and even Republicans who are saying, you know, I'm a conservative, but I can't get down with this dereliction of duty.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it was definitely worthwhile. The Center for Popular Democracy. Tell us about Center for Popular Democracy and what it does.
Yeah. So Center for Popular Democracy and our sister organization, which is our political arm, CPD Action, we're a network of grassroots organizations. So the people who are in your community fighting for higher wages, fighting for accountability of employees, you know, organizing unions, fighting toxic waste, fighting for access to housing and healthcare, those folks that you see on the street corners protesting or shutting down freeways, it's likely that if you're in one of the 34 states that our affiliates are in, you're actually engaging with our network. You're engaging with one of our affiliates. And for a long time, we really just looked to build collective power, but on the ground, locally. You know, that's old saying, like, all change happens locally or starts locally. We really believe that. But with the election of this administration, our network really understood in a very visceral way, right, that building a progressive or a blue city is not going to be enough to protect your family and your community from the reach of this administration, particularly with immigration enforcement, but obviously with the attacks on people on Social Security and disability benefits, you know, the attacks on the seniors and elderly, cutting Meals on Wheels. So we decided, you know, as a network, we wanted to build a federal program, a federal arm that really can fight back and then hopefully fight forward, right? Put forward the ideas that we believe will make this country a place where we can all thrive. So that's what our network does every day. And we are on the ground floor of fights for universal housing for everyone to make sure that, you know, people can actually have a roof over their heads and a home to thrive, fundamentally transforming our immigration system so that it is focused on humanitarian efforts and not on criminalization, and, you know, really transforming the criminal legal system, which since its inception essentially has operated as an offshoot of slavery, you know, really transforming it to be about what justice and safety for all really looks like in our communities.
So would it be fair to say, as you mentioned, a network of grassroots organizations, a lot of local and grassroots organizations spread out everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You guys kind of help facilitate bringing them all together into one big fist, don't you?
Absolutely. We have 55 organizations in 34 states, Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. Not only that, but we are multiracial, multigender, multigenerational, multigeographic. And so, you know, we are trying to practice this act of democracy through the building of our network and our organization. We are a third led by Black folks, a third led by Latinx folks, and a third led by white folks who are doing anti-racist organizing in places like Ohio and Indiana and West Virginia and New Hampshire, who really understand that, you know, this thing of white supremacy, which are, you know, we have two big goals. One is to confront white supremacy, and the other is to confront and hopefully someday end racial capitalism. And so when I tell you we got white folks in Indiana who are talking about white supremacy and confronting racial capitalism, it's because they understand that it might be a noose around the neck of people of color, but for many of the white people that they grew up around who are struggling, you know, really, really hard in this economy, this thing of white supremacy, this putting, you know, Trump and his hateful rhetoric over their own interests is really acting like a knife in their back. And so we're really trying to have that conversation with white folks in this country. I mean, lots of people have been trying to have that conversation with white folks for a real long time. But I think, you know, we are trying to, our network is really trying to do that hard work.
And in terms of that, let me run some by you, because one of the things I've said that I wish, that I think is a good way to explain it, and I have tried to encourage others to say it, is to show white folks how white supremacy hurts them economically. Mm-hmm. And if we go back to Dr. King, Rem Barb and I talk about this a lot of time, the speech Dr. King gave at the Montgomery State Capitol, which is obviously overshadowed by I Have a Dream. But he said that, you know, racism and racial stigmas and racial hatred and paranoia and fear-mongering are used to distract white people from the fact that they're being fleeced economically.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I just wish, don't you think that there ought to be a way to convey that a little better so that people can get it? And Trump has been a mastermind of it, you know, building up a level of hatred, you know, and then folks like, that's why I'm against Obamacare and for the Affordable Care Act. No, that's a trick. I mean, that's, you know, it seems to me there has to be a way to get that message across.
I mean, the reality is that the way to get that message across is you have to talk to people, right? And, you know, I even think about this election, being a part of the Sanders campaign, we are seeing people from all walks of life come into a political revolution and a political movement. And, you know, particularly Latino folks and particularly young Black people who have felt that this system doesn't represent them at all. And so, you know, when you ask them, well, what did it for you? So many of them are like, well, somebody finally talked to me. They didn't just assume that I couldn't vote when they came to my door. They didn't just assume that I, you know, had a felony conviction and wasn't able. They had a conversation with me. Mm-hmm. So I think white folks, a lot of struggling white folks in these communities are very, very isolated, right? There's not public transit to large cities. They're not near large cities. They're not near population centers. They don't have a lot of experience meeting people of color. I know for folks like on the coast, that seems mind-boggling, but I grew up in Wisconsin, and if you didn't travel to Milwaukee, right, there was a good chance that you could go get all the way to college and have never had like a real relationship with a single person of color.
Wow.
So in you know, now in this era, right? So I think that that's really important for us, and it's why we say we have to do this work. We have to have the conversations, but we can't have a false sense of unity. We can't just go talk to people about economics and ignore race and then hope that we're somehow going to be able to build alignment together and build power together. Rashad Robinson from Color of Change, he said this really incredible thing at the height of the resistance after Trump was elected, and it sticks with me nonstop. He said, people could learn to hate Trump and never learn to love Black people, and we won't be any better off after this administration is gone.
Mm.
That was really powerful to me.
Mm.
Everything that I am doing in my political life right now is really in reference to that powerful statement that I have to engage in a way that helps people understand and brings people to the beauty and the magic that Black people have and possess in this country, right? The freedom that we desire and that we deserve. And so that's why I'm trying to engage.
So speaking of Bernie, Center for Popular Democracy. So how does that, did you all endorse him? Did you interview all the candidates and go through a process at all? What happened?
So CPD Action is our political arm, and we had a very long process. We started building a federal agenda with our affiliates almost a year ago, where they really named what are our top priorities, healthcare, housing, justice transformation, immigration, the environment, et cetera. And then we had a big people's convention, thousands of our members in Detroit, and we asked every candidate to participate to be able to start our endorsement process. In that process, the only candidates who chose to actually make time to engage with our members were Secretary Castro, Senator Warren, and Senator Sanders. We did a straw poll with all of the candidates on it, and that gave us some information about where our network and our members were leaning. And then we began to do candidate questionnaires. We had several candidates fill out those questionnaires. But Secretary Castro, Senator Warren, and Senator Sanders really rose above the pack. And it was clear that they were really the only three candidates who were willing to hold a progressive sort of standard bearer sense. And so we made them our finalists. We sort of said, we're done like providing you access to our people. You clearly don't want their endorsement.
Yeah.
And it was sad because there were some of, you know, I was thinking about Senator Harris, for example, who just made very clear very early on that she wasn't interested in seeking our endorsement, even though
really?
Many people in our network were holding out support, trying to really wanting to hear from her.
When you say she made it clear, she was, I mean, she did
she was
really
asked multiple times,
really?
And she declined to participate. And I think, you know, if you look at sort of how she began to form her campaign, she really did not try deeply to engage grassroots organizations. I think she had a sense that the progressive left was not going to take her candidacy seriously or give her a fair shot. Certainly her record as a prosecutor played heavily into the reason why our members wanted to engage with her and have a question and be able to actually ask questions to her. And, you know, I think her being unwilling to really come to the table and to listen to why, you know, people are concerned about the way she defends her record made it very hard for our network, who definitely wants to, you know, root for everybody black, to support her. But we did have three candidates that we supported. They came in and did interviews with members from all over the country, in-person interviews. And I'll be real with you, I was a little bit shocked. Like, you know, these are car wash workers and daycare workers and McDonald's workers and, you know, people who work in fields and people who are unemployed and are on disability. These are people who are recovering from drug use. These are folks who are just regular people, none of them with any significant, you know, money in their pocket. And here are three top contending presidential candidates who are willing to sit for hours in a room and have real deep conversations with them about the future of this country. And I think it's because, like, labor has really sat down in this primary. You know, I think there have been less than 100 independent labor endorsements thus far.
Why do you think that is? I found out you read my mind because I was like, what's up with
you? I was like, why do you think that is? I mean, first of all, our brothers and sisters in labor are struggling and they're scared, right? We have not updated the labor laws in this country since the formation of the union movement. Mm-hmm. And the labor laws are out of date and, you know, for the type of work that we now, that primarily makes up our economy. And so labor's terrified. If you see where a lot of the gains in labor organizing have been, it's been in public sector, and it's been in really the nonprofit sector. Media has also been a place where labor organizing has grown. And, you know, I think that's for a reason. It's because we hold certain, you know, my staff is unionized, and we hold certain values that makes it easy for, you know, labor, or easier for labor organizing to happen. But that is not the case for Walmart, for Amazon.
Of course not.
And so I think, A, they're scared, so they don't want to alienate anybody. B, I think, you know, I'll be honest with you. I think that if you asked the majority of labor union membership to vote, the vast majority of them would vote, the rank and file, would vote to endorse Senator Bernie Sanders. And I think that there are some labor unions, for various reasons, where the, you know, the leadership of the union is terrified of a Sanders nomination.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to me speaks volumes about, you know, what are you really building? For us, we were really clear, and people know this. I have been an Elizabeth Warren fan for a really long time. I went through this process understanding that it was my members and not me who were going to decide who we are going to endorse. And then my job is to go do everything I can do to make sure their will is done. And so, you know, it became very, very clear in our network as they engaged with Senator Sanders that he was the right candidate for them, that he was a movement candidate they saw themselves in. And what I think was really powerful is that it really spread across race, across geography, across immigration status. I mean, the diversity of the number of the amount of folks who are supporting Sanders is just, it's unlike anything I've experienced, and I've been organizing for 20 years.
But now, if I heard what you said, though, if it had been your personal preference, that you're accountable to your organization, which is more than admirable and appropriate, but you were kind of leaning toward Elizabeth Warren.
I think I want to be clear. I have been working with Senator Warren for many, many years, even before she became a senator, as she was putting together the CFPB. And, you know, we have pushed her very hard. People inside my network have pushed her very hard to adopt a race analysis. When people say, oh, she really gets race, sometimes I chuckle because I remember being in small rooms with her like 7 years ago and saying, you're not talking about race enough. You need to really center race. So it's like I chuckle about it because this is how power works, right? You push people and then they amend their positions.
Right.
You know, I thought that she should have ran in 2016, and I was part of a group. I signed on to a group that tried to draft her to run. You know, I was disappointed that she didn't.
She would have won a nomination, I think.
I think she would have won the nomination, and I was disappointed that she didn't run. And, you know, I came into this believing that she would be an absolutely strong candidate, but keeping my mind open. I feel that Secretary Castro ran a race that, you know, is incredibly admirable.
Yeah.
And really pushed the issues. And I think a lot of the things we're talking about, transgender rights, for example, we wouldn't be discussing were it not for the way he ran his campaign.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And his campaign manager, Maya, gets a lot of credit for that.
Right.
You know, but again, I just, there's something about when you're with Senator Warren one-on-one. But for me, I'm not living a lavish lifestyle, but I'm doing okay. You know, I'm getting by. I have health care. I have insurance. I can make my rent payment every month, right? Like all of these things. I knew that, you know, I would be fine under a Warren administration. I'll be fine under a Sanders administration. I mean, I will do okay probably even under another 4 years of Donald Trump, right? Like I am doing okay. It means something to me that the folks who are struggling most in this country, low-income folks, no-income folks, low-wage workers, young people who do not see their place and have the highest rates of suicide we've seen in this country, it means something that they are putting and pinning their aspirations and their hopes and dreams in this campaign.
Right.
And I think anybody who dismisses that, you know, who tries to undermine it, like if we care about this country, we should be exploring it. We should be interrogating it. We should be investigating why, like what's motivating them, because that's how we're going to change the country. We got to take all of these millions of people who are part of this political revolution and who are doing this work, and we got to keep them the day after the election engaged in organizing and fighting for the issues that actually matter. We can't see an election as an end-all be-all way to make this country better. It never has been that.
You mentioned that some of the labor leadership and obviously some of the establishment is terrified of a Bernie Sanders nomination. Talk to us about how you feel about that and why you think that that's unacceptable or misplaced.
Yeah, I mean, you see rank and file members of IBEW are calling on their union to rescind their endorsement of Biden. Certainly, we saw it in the culinary workers tiff that happened in Las Vegas, where, members, people called them Senator Sanders supporters, but they were really members of the culinary union, were saying you're misrepresenting the senator's plan on immigration. You're misrepresenting what Medicare for All does and will do in a mailing that was going to all of their members about how to vote. It was a voter guide mailing. And so, you know, I think that the thing about this country, right, is like we don't wheel and deal in justice and fairness. We wheel and deal in power. And power comes usually by, you know, figuring out who you can exclude and exploit. And I think that, you know, that is, we see that as like a right thing, but actually it is just about power. Like, think about this. In the most criminal, I come from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Literally the worst city in America to be black. Like if you Google worst place in America to be black, Milwaukee, Wisconsin comes up. Our city has never elected black mayor. Never. Not one time. Even though it's a majority people of color, majority plurality black city, right?
Right.
And, you know, at the same time, there are lots of black elected officials in Milwaukee, just like there are in places like Chicago and Atlanta and Baltimore and many of these other places. When you look at the most criminalized cities in the country and you realize that those decisions happen at the city council and mayoral level, and then you go look at the city council and mayor, you realize Democrats are the ones who are criminalizing our folks the most.
Right.
In Milwaukee, they're spending 50% of the general purpose revenue just on policing. Half of the city budget just on policing. And so, you know, I think that, like, there's a real reason why people feel disengaged in politics, and it's very intentional, right? It's why we're Donald Trump is doing everything he can do to suppress the census, right? Suppress Latinos in the census, because it's about hoarding power and resources.
Right.
It's about, you know, it's why, you know, in Florida, they are trying to prevent folks who have earned back their constitutionally protected right to vote, right? There was an amendment for that passed more than 60% of the vote. And then promptly after it passed, the state legislature and the Republicans found a way to add a poll tax to that to prevent people from actually being able to vote. And so, you know, that's not about, oh, we just want to have free and fair elections. That's about, we got to suppress these black folks from voting.
Right.
So, you know, we're up against real threats. And I think that, you know, for a number of people in labor, corporate Democrats, moderates, what they want to do is go back to the status quo. They're not trying to fundamentally change the system. They're actually doing okay. Like I said, some of us are, you know, we're doing okay in the system. They're not trying to change that. They want to go back to the Obama years. And I think what you've seen in the rise of resistance and the way people of color, particularly in, you know, groups like Mi Gente and Black Lives Matter, the way that folks are engaging in politics right now is a very clear rejection of the status quo. It's not just a rejection of Donald Trump, and I think we got to be really clear about that. Folks are not putting everything on the line, donating every last cent they have, you know, knocking thousands and thousands of doors, sending millions of text messages because they want to go back to the status quo of previous administrations. They're doing it because they see this as a once-in-a-generation opportunity to fundamentally restructure and shift power in this country. You know, when these young people say they believe education should be free, it's because they know that it is that it is a trap for them that they are forced to go into. And they know that they have lots of peers who were just as talented, but were not able to go to college. Right. When young people talk about climate, they're serious about it because they realize that, like, you guys will be gone in 20, 30 years. But us and our kids, you know, we're going to be dealing with the catastrophes and the ramifications of your decisions.
So as a Sanders supporter and as someone representing Sanders supporters, what happens at the convention? I mean, I think we're probably moving toward a brokered convention. I mean, and that's just mathematically, you know, the way it's set up is proportional delegate allocation. Mm-hmm. And some of the recent math I've seen says that for any one person to get there and reach 1991 before the convention, they literally have to win a little over 55% of the vote in every single state after. And with so many people in, you know, getting 55% is going to be even harder. You can get 40, you can get 49, but at 55. If for some reason, because so if you have a brokered convention, those same fears you described come up, goes to a second ballot.
Yeah.
Superdelegates come back in. They, you know, wield their power again. If Bernie Sanders does not win the nomination, doesn't that do, and correct me if I'm wrong, irreparable harm? I mean, I just see a lot of Sanders supporters feeling as if, once again, it was rigged against him. Trump is going to invest a lot of money into promoting that online through social media. What happens?
I mean, so let me just say our network chose to endorse Senator Sanders. 75% of our affiliates voted to endorse Senator Sanders. That's a significant number.
Yeah.
I mean, that we were sort of like, oh, you know, is it going to be 51, 52? We thought at one point we might have to do a dual endorsement. And really, in the last sort of 3 weeks of our process, the senator really separated himself, and that strength of the endorsement came out. It would be very strange to me for the party who spent the last several years saying Hillary won, talking about the popular vote and how she got 3 million more votes and the most votes for president of any Democrat. And, you know, that has been the unfairness of the Electoral College system has been a part of our consciousness as Democrats in very significant ways. I'd say all the way back to 2000 and Al Gore, right?
Right.
I am firmly for abolishing the Electoral College and going to a national popular vote system. And I think that anybody who truly believes in democracy should also be supportive of that. And this was the Democrats' position in the last election, is that the delegate or the candidate who has the most support, pledged delegates, should be the nominee and was the nominee in Secretary Clinton, right?
Right.
And if the party was against superdelegates and you know, brokered convention and trying to, you know, play around with the math when, it, you know, back in 2016, then we should be against it now. And so I will say I was incredibly disappointed to watch the debate and to see only one candidate say that the candidate who got the most votes in the primary should be the party's nominee. I just firmly believe that. And I adhered to it in 2016, and I went out and I voted for Secretary Clinton, and I, you know, did my part to try to help make her the next president of the United States. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. it didn't work. Mm-hmm.
So tell us about some of the specific campaigns
yeah.
that CPD and CPD Action are involved in,
yeah.
if you would.
I would say, you know, first and foremost, you know, one of the things that brought us to Senator Sanders was the way that he has grown and followed the leadership of the movement, the immigrant rights movement, mm-hmm. in his immigration policy. And so, you know, there are many candidates in this race who have immigration plans that would be significantly better than Donald Trump. Like, let's be clear about that. But only Senator Sanders is pledging a moratorium on deportations from day one of his administration. And I think what our members, who, you know, a third of them are Latinx and immigrants, what our members said is our lives aren't bargaining chips. We don't want you to use something as a negotiation tactic. We want you to do it because it's the right thing to do and it'll save people's lives. And so they really were drawn to Senator Sanders there. We need to transform our immigration system. We are going into an era in this world in which migration is going to happen more and more because of environmental disasters, because of war, because of shortage of water, because of famine. We cannot base our immigration system on criminalizing people who are at the worst moments of their life, who are yearning to be free, who are coming to us, you know, really because their basic survival depends on it. So that's a big part of it. Another issue, and you heard Senator Sanders talk about this at the debate a lot, 500,000 people sleeping on the streets in this country. And I'm in L.A.,
yeah,
and
I
will
say,
tell
you, from
you
LA.
In the 4 years I've been in L.A., every year homelessness gets worse and worse and worse. Mm. I mean, it's to the point where folks are really living their full lives, like not in transition, but really their full lives out in the streets. And instead of acknowledging that and figuring out, you know, how do we, what are our levels of triage? How do we build more housing? You know, previous status quo administrations have led to a situation in which in 2018, 80% of all of the rental housing that was built was high-end luxury housing.
Yeah.
This is at the height of the homelessness crisis, right? And we're building high-end, 80% of the housing we're building is high-end luxury housing. So Senator Sanders has a plan for that. And it's you know, more, he will invest more in housing, both building affordable housing, the creation and maintaining of public housing, and a host of other factors, rent control. He's investing trillions more than any of his competitors. And so, you know, for us, this is a problem that has to be on the scale. And to be clear, this is not a supply and demand issue, because as I said, both, you know, the housing that's being built isn't being built for people who can actually rent it. But also in places like San Francisco, right, where you have this big explosion of homelessness, you've got, I think it's something like 5 empty apartments for every person who's homeless in San Francisco. And so, the vacation rentals, the Airbnbs, and, you know, again, the luxury building at rents that are unaffordable even to stable working families, much less people who are living in poverty, has led to a situation where you got homes sitting empty, people out on the streets, but no political will to match those things together.
Right.
Senator Sanders really, I think, stuck out for us there. The other issue I want to talk about is justice transformation. And we don't even call it criminal justice reform anymore, because we have to understand, and if anybody has not been to the Legacy Museum in Alabama, you need to go. Because if you are not an abolitionist before you go there, when you leave the Legacy Museum, what you will understand is that the system is not broken. It doesn't need to be tinkered around the edges. It is operating exactly how it was designed to operate, from slavery to Jim Crow to you know, the just like generations and legacies of terror, right? This system is operating exactly how it was designed. Right, right. And so we now talk about justice transformation. We talk about how do we build a system that is rooted in healing, rooted in caring for trauma, rooted in allowing people to rehabilitate and to repair the harm that is done. And we've worked really closely with Ayanna Pressley to introduce the People's Justice Guarantee. And her bill, the legislation that she has authorized, it goes past just repealing the 1994 crime bill, which has been a signature campaign of ours. And we're proud to say that both Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, and Secretary Castro all committed to repealing the 94 crime bill as part of our endorsement process. And we're really, really proud of that. But Ayanna Pressley's bill goes past that. It actually establishes a federal people's process that would go to the most incarcerated communities in the country and ask them to design a new bill that really is rooted in their safety that she would introduce. So this is a really exciting thing that we had introduced. And while she's with Senator Warren, and we're proud of her for making her decision, we have to say that Senator Sanders' plan, a justice transformation plan, just stands out above the rest. You know, from ending cash bail to legalizing marijuana, not just legalizing it, but providing reparations to the people who have been harmed by its prohibition. And, you know, this is really big for us because we believe that the right to vote is fundamental, and it's the way that our people have been suppressed for generations is to deny us that right. Senator Sanders is the only candidate who believes that all people, all citizens of this country, regardless of whether or not they are currently or formerly incarcerated, deserve the right to vote. And if he were president, he would ensure that people, every citizen, has the unabridged right to vote. That, to me, is fundamental, because if it exists for people who are behind bars, who are incarcerated currently, then it will exist for our people who are just in ghettos, right? Who are just, right, you know, in the barrios, who are just in, you know, who are just farm workers and who don't have access to all of the resources. If it exists for people who are incarcerated, it will exist for everyone. Yeah. And so, you know, it is really critical to us that we elect a candidate who understands that people are not the worst thing they've ever done. Mm. And we don't stop being people because we've harmed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a very good point. So Senator Sanders gets the nomination. Last question, put you on the spot. Mm-hmm. Who does he pick for his running mate?
Listen, I think everybody should pick Stacey Abrams. If she will accept it, then Stacey Abrams should be our vice president. I don't care who whose ticket she's on. But if she doesn't accept it, I would say that, I think at this point, the progressive left needs to be thinking about how we're going to consolidate power. My sense is that Senator Sanders will continue to rise. And so I'm hoping that Senator Warren will play a key role in his administration. Whether that's as vice president or maybe chairwoman of the Fed, of the Federal Reserve.
Right, right, right. So, Stacey Abrams, I think that's a consensus.
Yeah.
Frankly, I think if it gets brokered and nobody can agree, the one person everybody likes is Stacey.
Exactly.
So maybe she should just be president. You know,
Let's do it.
Yeah, that
Wait,
might
can
be,
we make that happen?
Yeah,
How
right.
can we make that happen?
Right. So I'm also hearing that if Stacey Abrams doesn't want to be on a ticket, then because clearly everybody's thinking black woman.
Yes.
Then the second choice would be Kamala Harris in that slot. Is that doable to you or no?
I will vote for that ticket happily. I don't think it's the best ticket.
Okay.
You know, I think.
And is that because of the criminal justice concerns?
I think that there are significant criminal justice concerns, but I will vote for that ticket happily. I have a lot of respect for Senator Harris. I thought she was impeccable in the Kavanaugh hearings. I don't think it's the ticket that will excite the base that Bernie has been building. You know, the okay. other day, somebody said, what if Bernie doesn't pick a politician at all? What if somebody like, what if he picks someone like Choke Lumumba, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, for example?
Yeah, yeah.
Or what if he picks Desmond Meade, who led the Florida Restoration of Rights Coalition to winning voting rights back right. for millions of voters in Florida.
Right.
Like, what if he even floats these types of names before he makes his decision?
Right.
So I think there could be an interesting thing where he picks somebody who isn't who hasn't been trying to be president their, whole life, and what that would mean for everyday people. What if he picked a labor leader, for example, a leader of a big major national union? So I think that if Elizabeth Warren is amenable to it and if they can negotiate it before we get to convention so that it's possible for states like Wisconsin and New York and Michigan for all of those progressive votes to go to Senator Sanders, I think it's an interesting conversation to have. And I think many people would be happy to have Senator Warren as their vice president. But I also think that, you know, it would be great for Senator Sanders to start talking about non-conventional people and getting that conversation going. That would be fun.
But before we go, let me just ask you about Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
You being from or living in California now, all the concerns about her criminal justice record, why were there no concerns when she was attorney general?
I would not say there were no concerns. I mean, there were lots of people who were, you know, talking particularly about her truancy program that targeted parents whose children were truant, often low-income parents who had the least resources. I think there were a lot of conversations here. I want to be clear, Kamala Harris came up as a prosecutor in a very particular era in our criminal justice system, sort of this tough on crime like era, right? She was coming up on the tail end of that, where the movement for Black Lives had not shown a spotlight on the massive inequity in our system in the way that we know it to be today. Mm-hmm. I think that the issue for me is not that she, you know, supported these policies or that she made decisions as a prosecutor that as a former public defender I didn't necessarily agree with. The issue is that she seems to have not learned much from it, right? The way she talks about her record, she was questioned on it many times, and she's doubled down and said, I'm very proud of the work that I did. And she hasn't spent a lot of time talking about knowing what I know now, here's what I would do differently. And I think, you know, to contrast that with Senator Sanders, who also voted for the 1994 crime bill, we pushed him very, very hard on that. Why did you vote for that? What was your rationale? He talked about the Violence Against Women's Act and feeling how important it was. He talked about the assault weapons ban, which he wanted to support, which was very, very hard for him to take in Vermont, but he took it. And he talked about his floor speech where he said, clearly, I will want to spend this money on education, on investment, not on criminalization, but this seems like a balance, right? And he apologized. He said, I'm sorry. It was a bad vote. I will repeal it, and I will work with you to make it better, right? I think that's what people needed Kamala to do, and she wasn't willing to do it. And so I think that's the thing that politicians – and if you listen to how people talk about Senator Warren, it's the thing they like best about her. It's her willingness to listen and shift and adjust based on what people say. So anyway, that's my free piece of advice for Senator Harris. She can take it or leave it because, you know.
But let me ask you this, though. So as a woman, though, even if she had, Bernie has never really been, people have never really made an issue out of his vote for the crime bill. Mm. They made a big issue out of it for Hillary, even though she never voted for it. I mean, it pretty much killed her.
Yeah.
A lot of the same people, including Black people, or allegedly Black folk, who had a problem with Kamala Harris's criminal justice record, are silent on Bloomberg.
Bloomberg and Klobuchar.
Yeah. So what is, from your point of view, I mean, isn't that still somewhat of a double standard? I mean, Kamala wasn't a Bloomberg.
No, not by any means. And like I said, if she had won the nomination, I would have happily gone to vote for her.
Why do you think people are harder on her than they are?
I mean, I think you already know. Race and gender compound, right? And this is why we say identity politics are important, right? Because we might share an identity as a woman, we might share an identity as a Black person. The way that being a Black woman and the like challenges on your existence in this world are special and unique, which is why you have Klobuchar getting a pass and Kamala getting, you know, taken to, you know, to the carpet. I think that my dream, and it's interesting because going back to Milwaukee one last time, we've got a mayor's race happening in Milwaukee.
Okay.
And the white mayor.
Is a Black person running for mayor this time?
So a Black woman is running for mayor.
Good. Okay.
The white mayor has been mayor for 16 years. If he wins, he will have, you know, go on to his 20th year as mayor. And he's a white man who has presided over the worst city in America to be Black for 16 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, The woman who's running against him, State Senator Lena Taylor, is somebody who I have had many political battles with, right? We have gone up against each other on her support for voucher and charter schools. We've gone up against each other on her, position on guns and gun safety. you know, we have gone up against each other on her positions around economic development and the minimum wage. And I never thought I'd say this, but yesterday I made a Facebook post and I asked all my friends and family in Milwaukee to vote for her for mayor.
Is that right?
Because, you know, here's the thing. She will be at least as competent. Like, she literally can't be worse because it's already the worst as the white mayor. And so for me, I say, let's give a majority people of color city over to the governance to people of color. And let's trust black and brown organizations to push them to be better, because they'll have to do that with a white mayor or with a black mayor. So let's go ahead and make history. So thing with Kamala Harris, like, I really wanted a black woman president. I kept our space for her in our endorsement process. I probably was one of the hardest pushers for her in the endorsement process. Right. She didn't want to participate. So there's nothing I can do about that. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, what I've learned from this race, and I'll wrap up with this, is that we are better representatives of our needs than any career politician ever will be. And so, you know, I want to encourage people who have been inspired by whatever campaign you're inspired by, Bernie's campaign, by Warren's campaign. Right. There are black progressives out there. There are black socialists out there. Mm-hmm. We rarely run for office. If I had one dream, it would be in 2021. So many people who got skills on this campaign will turn around and apply those skills to running for office themselves. We need to fundamentally transform who is in office and make sure more of us have power.
Indeed, indeed. Jennifer Epps Addison, very active, folks. You can, I'm sure you can hear her energy in her voice. She's very, very busy and doing a lot of great work. The Center for Popular Democracy, if you want to have your finger on the pulse of what's going on the ground with a lot of grassroots work and organizing organizations and organized labor, popularddemocracy.org. Visit the website, get involved, make a donation. I think you can tell we'll be hearing much, much more from Jennifer Epps Addison in the weeks and months and years maybe to come. And we're so glad you stopped by. Appreciate
your
insight.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And we look forward to doing much more work with you. Center for Popular Democracy at popularddemocracy.org. Thanks, everybody. Thank you for listening to Make It Plain and Get Woke. Remember to listen, like, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts. Also, subscribe to Make It Plain and Get Woke daily. Check out makeitplain.com to subscribe. If all minds are clear, it has been made plain.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.